Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Salera Report. You're in for a very special treat today. We have a certifiable Salera hero, and his name is Michael Schumann. He is someone that Carolyn Betts and I have known since the mid-90s, when we were in the process of getting into cahoots with him on local investment when we got interrupted. But he kept plowing in and digging in. I was just telling him one of my allies always says it's 10,000 hours to master any topic. And he's clearly blown by the 10,000 hours. He's got a new book that we reviewed up on the website, Put Your Money Where Your Life Is, How to Invest Locally Using Self-Directed IRAs and Solo 401ks. Now, to a certain extent, that makes us US-centric today, but there's a lot in here that's going to be useful to everybody who's not necessarily in the US and using vehicles other than IRAs and 401ks. But anyway, so I just want to say, Michael, that we so appreciate the fact that you stay true to pursuing local investment. We think you've done great work, and we're just thrilled to sort of reconnect with you and to have you on the Salera Report.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that and look forward to our conversation today.
Okay, so Carolyn, you're going to be the lead today. You've had a wonderful course with Michael and his group. So, and you've prepared an outline, so why don't you take over?
Okay, yes, I sent Michael an outline of things I thought we could cover, and he said, well, that's 20 hours worth of So we're gonna see how it goes, and you know, maybe he comes back to go into more detail. I wanted, since you're a published author, and of course you have books, I wanted to just hold up three of your books. You have more than this, but this one is the most recent one, and it is about 401k, solo 401ks and IRAs, using those in local investing, but that's not it's not all about that. That's just like a chapter or something. So that's the most recent one. This is a great one, Local Economy Solution, and that came out in 2015, is that right, Michael?
Yes.
And Going Local was one that he says was written in 1998, and the paperback is published in 2000. But, you know, these ideas are still good. There are a lot of things that have happened even since the most recent book, like the pandemic and shutdown of a huge percentage of the businesses in this country. So, but that doesn't change the idea of investing locally and what kinds of risks there are and all of that. So I encourage you. You are basically a consultant as well as an author, correct?
So I split my time three ways, roughly evenly. One third is I teach for a business school, which is Bard College has a green MBA program. And then another third is I work as a contractor, a senior economist for a consultancy called Council Fire. And then the last third is really the local investment portfolio. And I have a newsletter that I invite people to subscribe to. It's free, called the Main Street Journal, where every 2 weeks we try to contain links and ideas of what's going on in the field so people can keep up with it.
And we met the second time, I guess, when I attended a virtual conference with people all over the country, and it was sponsored by a local nonprofit in Montana. And it was aimed at people both interested in being entrepreneurs and raising money, or who had existing businesses and wanted to raise money locally, as well as people who wanted to invest. And I want to say it was a great experience. It was over, I think, 4 weeks, an hour each time. We had homework. I didn't do all the homework, but I saw what it was, and it was fabulous. And I would, you know, say that, you know, another group could do something similar and skip over some of the hard work by using some of the materials and experiences you have.
Yeah, what we had in the course, it's worth saying, is in addition to our time together, there were 15 or so 30 to 40 minute videotapes that were kind of in depth on a lot of the issues we'll just kind of walk through today. And then I did just put in the Main Street Journal links to a bunch. I think I did about 50 short 5-minute videos that anyone can access. And if you just go to the Main Street Journal page, you'll see those at some point. And because I'm sure you'll have questions about local investment and crowdfunding and the like.
Okay, great. Well, let's start out with the first question is, why do we care about local investing?
Yeah, I think there's really two reasons here that are worth focusing on. The first one is that we should care about local business, that is locally owned business. And people don't appreciate that depending on how you define local, locally owned business or locally owned institutions like hospitals, schools, local government, they're responsible for between 60 and 80% of the jobs in the U.S. economy. This is a sector that is highly profitable, except for startups. It is competitive. It is where there's a lot of dynamism and entrepreneurship. It's the sector that is most clearly supporting local economic development through income, wealth, and jobs because local businesses spend more of their money locally. It's connected with environmental protection, with walkability, with political participation, with volunteership, with civil society. So there's a lot of reasons we ought to love our local businesses. The second point is that when you look at our investment behavior, we have a total capital market failure. And when I say a capital market failure, what I mean is that in a more or less healthy capital marketplace, we would be putting 60 to 80% of our investment dollars into the 60 to 80% of the businesses of our economy. But in fact, we systematically ignore those businesses. And because of problems in securities laws, because of practices we've developed over the years, because of bad behavior, we now put almost all of our money into Wall Street rather than into this core sector on Main Street. And I would argue it's really hard to solve a bunch of local problems, everything from housing to energy to poverty to economic development, unless we fundamentally change our investment behavior. And so local investment is really an invitation for people to start shifting their behavior from putting money into global capital markets and putting it back into their community.
So can I just jump in and ask you, see if I can add a third? I would say one is quality control. If you want to get excellence in local fresh food or in fresh food, if you want to get excellence in meat you can trust, if you want to get excellence in a bank that you can pick up a phone and talk to anybody, there's a real connection between investing in the businesses that you want to depend on and the importance of quality that you can't get if you go to Wall Street.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And one of the ways that I think about it is that the local economy is a relationship-based economy. Right. It's based on trust. It's based on good feelings or goodwill toward your neighbors. Whereas the global economy is based on a lot of anonymous and non-transparent kinds of relationships where lots of things can and do go sideways. Right. So I think it's true that having connection to the people around you, whether it's food or your local government, really does help in getting quality in your life.
I would also say that even when there's an overall recession or problems in the national economy, if you have a local area that is doing things, you know, producing things that people want to purchase and providing services that are useful, That goes a long way toward avoiding the job losses and other things that happen within large corporations. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that what we see time and again is that global companies that are moving factories or warehouses or other stores around are always looking to maximize rate of return, whereas a locally owned business needs a positive rate of return, not necessarily the maximum rate of return, which tends to work more in favor of the other stakeholders like workers in a business.
Right. And there are a lot of different kinds of local investment that we might not really think of as local investment, and some of it's traditional things like promissory notes, but local investment also includes investing in ourselves and our families and our physical surroundings, and sometimes taking money out of the market, mutual funds or whatever, and putting it into one's life is a good use of resources. Do you want to go through some of the different forms of local investing?
Absolutely. So
I'm skipping over.
Yeah, no, let's talk about first just investing in yourself. I have personally benefited from this idea in two ways, two anecdotes that I want to share. So the first was that in 2008, I had the misfortune of going through a divorce, a loss of job, and a global financial crisis all at the same time. And the combination put me in a terrible debt situation. And much of that debt was held in credit cards where I was paying 20-25% interest, and it was killing me. And the way that I got myself back on my financial feet is that I approached people that I knew, trusted, cared, most of whom were local to me, and said, look, you're getting, 5% in whatever you're doing in the market now. I'm paying 25%. Let's find a number in between that makes us both happy. And I was able, through that method, to get myself out of credit card debt. All the people have since been paid off. And I reckon I saved myself about $85,000 in interest payments. It was a huge home run. Now, there were still mistakes that I made with relationship to that. But getting yourself out of credit card debt or other forms of high interest debt, maybe student loan debt, is really an important way of investing in yourself and preventing those interest payments from leaving your community, which is a significant source of leakage. The other example that I want to give, so I recently moved to the desert in California, and in August, my electricity bill was $700 in the month. And that's when I thought, okay, time to put solar on the roof. So my wife and I put solar on our roof, and our electricity bill has since been zero. But more importantly, this investment will pay itself off in 4 years. It's just a hugely successful investment, much more successful than anything we could do with the marketplace.
And why don't you give us some examples of local investments in small businesses locally that you've learned about?
Yeah, so there is a website. It's a very crude website that a colleague and I created in Baltimore called the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange. And it's been up for about 3 years. The organization that it's connected with is called Community Wealth Builders. And what we do in this site is we just list all of the small businesses in Baltimore that are looking for local investment, so that Baltimore residents who are interested in this field, not a huge number, but some, know to come to this website and get guidance about what are the available investment opportunities out there. And just putting that information out there helped to get, I guess we would say, about $3 million into 45 BIPOC-led businesses and 6,000 investors. So it's small at some scale, but it does kind of show the power of local investing, that a lot of people, if they know what local investment options are available, and if they're comfortable with the basic facts about those investments, they're willing to do it. I mean, people aren't willing to put 100% of their money into local investments, but maybe 1 or 2%, and that's an important start. And to kind of just put this in a bigger perspective nationally, so the law made it expensive and difficult for a business, a small business, to raise even a penny of investment from a grassroots investor. And by grassroots investor, I mean not in the wealthiest 5% of the American public, which is sometimes called accredited investors. If you're in that 95%, you could not put a penny into a local business unless that business did $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of disclosure work with lawyers. Now, the Jobs Act was passed in 2012, implemented in 2016, to make it easier for small businesses to raise up to, initially it was $1 million, now it's $5 million of capital from grassroots Americans. And every American can put in up to $2,200 a year into these crowdfund offerings. And here's the results as of about a month ago, which is that since 2016, 1.5 million Americans have put in $1.8 billion of investment into nearly 7,000 companies. The average investment is close to $1,000. The average raise by a local business is close to $400,000. The most successful businesses have been those run by women and people of color, that is, those who were most deliberately excluded from capital markets. So again, it's, you know, it's not the entire marketplace, it's the beginning of something, but it's not trivial either.
I want to know how much of that money that was raised went out in fees.
So they're typically, the crowdfunding platforms are charging between 5% and 9% in fees, which is way too high. And one of the things, I mean, this is an interesting kind of next part of the evolution of this marketplace that needs to happen. There has been a tremendous consolidation of this marketplace. So I would say 80 businesses got licenses to put up what are called these investment portals. They have consolidated, they have taken one another over. Now 80% of the business is transacted, I believe, on 5 of them. And I'm not even sure those 5 will last as they are. But this is a function of, again, what the law has required. And many of us think we should continue to reform the law to make it still cheaper and easier with fewer fees for people to do these local investment transactions.
So describe to us what might be an alternative of a direct investment somehow to help small businesses in your immediate neighborhood, a business that you patronize, for example. How could that be done without going onto a crowdfunding platform?
Right. So there's a couple of approaches that you can take to this. So the simplest approach is to do pre-purchasing. It turns out that in most instances, pre-purchasing, that is buying in bulk something, is not a security. And so this has been a clever end run that websites like Credibles have used to get around securities laws. And I'll give you an example. When COVID hit, I wrote a blog called, Adopt a Local Business. And I really felt it was sort of morally important for us to find one business that we love that we would write a check to. So I wrote a check. At the time, I was still living in Washington, D.C. I wrote a check to my favorite restaurateur, a guy named Andy Shalal, who runs something called Busboys and Poets. And I said, Andy, here's a $1,000 check. I know it's a rough time. Just give me $1,000 in gift cards and I'll use it over time. But it gives you some money in advance at a time when you need it. And I talked about this with as many people as possible so that others would do this a similar thing. Well, he was so happy he gave me not $1,000, but $1,200 of gift cards. I'm still spending them, but that's a 20% rate of return. And I felt it was so successful that when my wife and I got married later that year, we didn't accept any wedding gifts, but we asked people to adopt local businesses in the same framework. And we raised $5,000 for local businesses where we live. So that's one thing you can do. Second thing you can form, and look, Solari has these great groups. Some of them, I'm guessing, either do local investing as an investment club or could do local investing as an investment club. And so just making these investments directly, I mean, you have to follow certain securities laws around this, but there are ways of keeping down the costs. And I think that would be another alternative to the investment crowdfunding.
I don't want to get into deep legal issues, but what about just loaning a local business with or without a lien on property? What's your feeling about how safe that is? I mean, really, it's a risk for the borrower who's the business rather than the person who's putting up the money. But, you know, assuming you want to make something that's largely legal, what's your feeling about that?
Yeah, I can see doing that and how it could be helpful. But it's a little tricky on the securities law front. So let's talk about something that is a clear dodge of securities law. So there is an organization that has been promoting local investment for 15 years called Slow Money. And it's all around investment in local food businesses and small farms, started by a guy named Woody Tash. They have a fund now that they call Beatcoin. And Beatcoin basically invites people to donate money into the fund. So there is no investment relationship there. And then they give zero interest loans to small businesses or farmers. So on neither side of that transaction is there a recognized security. And so securities law will pay it no attention. You could modify that ever so slightly. You could, you know, have people donate into a fund and then they give a loan with has some interest and just do some legal work around that fund making those loans. Or you could, put money into an investment club. And an investment club with fewer than 100 people, that also is an exemption of the Investment Company Act, and that usually is a cheap and easy way for people to pool money and engage in these activities. But it is, you know, the securities laws are like snakes out there, and they can bite you in unexpected ways. Like one of the ways that to me is just outrageous that securities laws can bite you is that if we were in this podcast to have just a very civilized conversation about, oh, I run a little publishing business and I'm looking for $10,000 in loans. Would you be willing to do that? This would be a violation. This conversation would be a violation of securities law. And to me, this is crazy. It's nuts. We need to work on reforming of this, but you have to structure your conversations in certain ways to remain compliant with the regulators.
Now, a general partnership interest, however, is not a security because you have a direct relationship with the business and you presumably have access to all the financials and you have some control. So entering into a general partnership interest with a business owner might be something that, I mean, the problem for the business owner is, you know, who wants somebody telling you what to do? But, you know, I just thought I would point that out.
Yeah, I think I know that you're absolutely right. And another example would be a co-op. Co-op memberships, thanks to an old Supreme Court ruling, are not considered securities.
And co-ops are a great way to get some local control on the quality of food and establish relationships with local farmers,
Right.
which is a win-win from both sides.
Yes. And it's worth underscoring here that local investing can apply to any kind of company out there, whether it is an S corp or C corp or a
A
co-op
farm.
or even a nonprofit.
Right. Well, now let's talk about a lot of our subscribers have IRAs and 401ks that they might say it's with an employer who they no longer work for. Can you explain to us how they can access that money for local investment and things that they really will really benefit them on a ground level rather than investing in the stock market?
Right. So the problem that people face right now when they use these traditional vehicles of tax deferment, so the IRA investment retirement accounts or the 401ks, which are related to for-profit workplaces or 401bs relating to nonprofits, and there's a bunch of other ones too. That are less common. The problem is that these are administered by companies that only give you publicly traded companies as investment options. Sometimes they'll give you municipal bonds too, but these are bonds that are traded internationally as well. So it is almost impossible with a conventional overseer of these accounts to invest locally. And if you have, say, you know, an account with TD Ameritrade and you say, well, I really want to do some investment in Andy Shalal's Busboys and Poets, they'll say, well, he's not listed, we can't do it. So the solo 401k and the self-directed IRA offer solutions to this problem. The self-directed IRA allows you to move your account to another account that's run by a custodian who basically follows your orders. And if you tell the custodian, I'm interested in investing in Busboys and Poets, if it is a legal transaction, and that's the only inquiry that they are empowered to look at, is it a legal transaction? Then they will work with you to help set it up. So, for example, going back to my earlier story about getting people to invest in my credit card debt. One of the people who invested my credit card debt invested his retirement account. So I worked with him to set up a self-directed IRA, and he then was able to do a debt note with me through his custodian, and that's how he did the transaction.
So can I just stop you for a second? I want to make it clear to everyone that let's say I have $200,000 in an IRA. I can peel off a small portion of that into a new self-directed IRA to do this. So it's not either or. I don't have to move all my money. I can just peel off a piece to do a self-directed IRA, right?
Yes, that's an important distinction. And yeah, you have pretty wide liberty to roll things over from one tax-deferred account to another. Let me mention the solo 401k because it has some different qualities and features that may be attractive to some of the people listening. So a solo 401k is designed for self-employed people, but it's not necessarily, you don't have to be self-employed exclusively. If you are self-employed as a second or third job and make $1, you can open a solo 401k, and that allows you to create your own bank account designated as your solo 401k. And then you, rather than the custodian, which was true in the self-directed IRA, you yourself enter these agreements, and you just have to follow the rules that were laid out by the institution that created the solo 401k. So there's more responsibility on you to know what you can and cannot do, but it's cheaper because you're not paying a custodian. Instead, you're just sort of renting this legal agreement for 5 or 6 years.
I just have to interrupt you one more time because this is really important. The beauty of this is there are many local investments, which are the kind of investments that I or somebody would like to make, but they're speculative or they're high risk, or it's a startup. You want to invest in a startup. And if you look at the financial benefits of doing it with pre-tax money as opposed to after-tax money, it's very powerful because if it fails, you know, the government's going to eat a big piece of that. In other words, you're sharing the losses with the government. And so there's really, to me, a solo 401k is an incredible, it can be an incredibly powerful tool, particularly if you want to do angel network kind of things. So I think this is very, yep. I'm just trying to say this is very important if you qualify.
Yeah, right. Totally agree. And one other thing I'll point out is that with a self-directed IRA, you're sort of following the rules of an IRA, which means you can put in, you know, seven-ish thousand dollars a year, maybe a little more if you're my age. But with a solo 401k, there are circumstances in which you can put in more than $120,000 in a given year. So it just is this... If you're, you know, if you've gotten a sudden inheritance, or if you have one of these jobs where you're a musician and one year is really successful and the others, you're just sort of getting by, this is a perfect vehicle for putting your money into tax deferred purposes. Now, if I could go back again to my divorce, this is where I made a huge mistake because my then wife transferred to me a big chunk of money from her retirement account. And because it was on a divorce decree, I did not have to pay penalties on it. And I thought, okay, I should pay off all my debts and emerge from the divorce debt free. What no one told me, including my attorneys, was actually the taxes on just that part of the transaction were going to kill me and put me in further debt. So what I should have done is taken that money and put it in a solo 401k and then use that to pay down the debt and then pay myself back in my 401k. Because a 401k, unlike a self-directed IRA, allows you to take a 5-year low-interest loan for anything, including the repayment of your personal debt. So that's, again, another powerful piece of this.
Wow. And you could, let's say you have kids who own houses. You could refinance one of your kids' houses if you've got a fairly big, say, existing 401k, or you have a chunk of money that comes in that's taxable, put it in a solo 401k, and have your offspring paying you instead of the JP Morgan Chase or some place that they might have a not terribly great mortgage servicer. And if they have a few months of trouble, they don't lose their house.
Yes. So this is where it's important to draw an interesting and hard to grasp legal distinction, which is technically it is illegal to use your self-directed IRA or your solo 401k to invest in yourself or your kids or you or your or their businesses. But with a solo 401k, because you can do up to a $50,000 loan to yourself for anything, that is an exemption that you can use. So you couldn't put more than 50,000 into your kid's house, but you could put 50,000 in and have them pay you back over 5 years.
And you could make the difference if it's a $150,000 house, you could use other funds that are not pre-tax. So you have two different loans, for example. Yes. Now, how much? What's the cost of establishing and keeping maintaining these two different vehicles?
So the best prices that I've found, and I should mention, if you're really interested in this topic, there's an organization called the Next Egg, which has a couple of hundred people that are struggling through all of these rules and questions together, and it's a good organization to be part of. So the Next Egg has lists of providers that they have out there. And if you look at those lists, probably the cheapest provider of a solo 401 of a self-directed IRA is Rocket Dollar, and they'll do maybe $250 a year, which I don't think is cheap. I really think it could be cheaper, but there's not enough competition out there to drive down the costs. And then for a solo 401k, Rocket Dollar has a pretty inexpensive option, but there's other ones out there. It's more like $300 for the 6-year period.
Well, that's pretty affordable. It's,
Yes.
yeah,
Yes.
maybe these things could be cheaper, but when you look at some of the fees you're paying for other aspects of investing, that's nothing. Let me ask you this. We talked briefly about this earlier. We're very much in favor of the establishment of sovereign state banks. And supporting local banks, which when I use the term bank, I include credit unions and savings and loans and savings banks. Isn't it possible for local banks, perhaps with or without support of a sovereign state bank, to have programs where the bank and local people who have money to invest could participate together in making loans for example, projects that they support?
Yes, and there are some precedents out there. It's unusual to find local banks that are willing to work with you on this, but I'll give you a few examples. So in the 1990s, the E.F. Schumacher Society created a program called Share with a local bank in the Berkshires. And the idea was people come up there in their summer homes and they take advantage of the Berkshires and then they leave. And so the push was for them to put money on deposit in this local bank, and that account collateralized small loans that went to various small businesses. Neat program, lasted for, I don't know, 10 years or so. Another program was with, there's a big credit union, alternatives credit union, it's called, in Ithaca, New York. And they had a similar program, except it was around kind of nonprofits, where you could work with a nonprofit and put money on deposit in support of your favorite nonprofit, and then the credit union would match it. So you got a 2x on your money, and that then supported the nonprofit with whatever its program was. And then a third example is in Boston. There was a bank there that worked with Equal Exchange, a co-op coffee company, to create a special note to support fair trade coffee companies. And the note was framed rather broadly, but it turns out it was just, the CD was just creating capital, created about $1 million of capital for Equal Exchange. So it was a great success story for Equal Exchange. But it's hard to find a lot more examples than that. And here's something that I've been thinking a lot about, which is, I think community banks are, you know, they're struggling to redefine themselves and give themselves a clearer competitive advantage over the big banks. And I think one of the ways they can do this is to be supportive of investment crowdfunding. So in North Carolina, there's a banker that I've worked with there named Roger Dick, who runs a bank called the Uwari. He's based in Albemarle, North Carolina. And he had a client, a big developer who was building a housing project in an old hotel building. The project was about $3 million. The developer and other investors were prepared to pony up about $1 million. The bank was prepared to put in $1 million, but they were still $1 million short. And so what they did is they organized a crowdfunding campaign and raised $1 million that way. And I think this is a very powerful way for banks to expand their options in saying yes to more kind of good community projects.
Well, and if you had a sovereign state bank, for example, that would purchase some percentage of the loan portfolios of the community banks, that would provide additional funding. And if the purchase of those loans were contingent upon somehow creating a vehicle for investment by residents of the state or local community or wherever, it seems to me that would be a way of jumpstarting this, if you'll
forgive
me using the word jumpstart, which is the first word in the Jobs Act.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And I think, I mean, one of the things to think about sort of legally is that these sovereign state banks can take advantage of the fact that, at least for some aspects of securities law, if you're doing it in state, you only have to follow the in-state laws. So if you can tweak in-state laws, you can facilitate a lot of what you're imagining here.
Well, and the likelihood that the Attorney General or the Securities Department is going to go after a transaction involving, you know, involving a partial investment by one of the community banks, you know, unless they're being funded by a huge bank that's trying to take over the community banks, that's not going to happen.
Right. So I'm sorry. Go on, Catherine.
Oh, so I just want to jump in tangentially because this reminds me of a great conversation I had with a group of bankers and community leaders in Michigan. I just want to make a pitch to involve the local schools and community colleges because, on one hand, you're trying to swing capital to be available, but I think the key to getting the investment result is to swing the young people back onto Main Street. Because the biggest strain in these communities is the young people are taking off and working for the big companies. And so if you can have a critical mass and the community colleges and the local schools are a big player, if you can get a critical mass that also swings in that critical mass of young people, then they don't disappear into the military and to the cities. And then you've really got something. We're talking startups there, which are a little bit more are somewhat riskier, but maybe it's worth the risk. When you've got kids, I'll call them kids, it could be a middle-aged person taking courses in entrepreneurship and running businesses through the local extension service or through a community college, they're learning things that a good business owner would need to learn. There's a trade-off in terms of risk, but some portion of the investable local capital can go toward new
Right, but
business.
there's a huge amount of boomers that are going to be selling over the next 10, 15 years,
Absolutely.
and you want young people coming up to buy up those businesses or else they're lost.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so some of the work that I've been doing in the last 5 years has been with Native American reservations, and in one, the Crow Reservation in sort of south central Montana. We developed what we've called the Business Innovation Center. So it's a business incubator, and they've gotten some federal money to help put that incubator together. But a critical piece is the role of the not well, what is effectively the community college, the tribal college, on the Crow Reservation. And I think trying to figure out, how you can do the training to support small businesses in these incubators and with these other programs, with these resources in community colleges, can be a real home run.
Right.
And don't forget farms and even enterprises like fishing, particularly with Native Americans. But if we want to protect our food sources from poisoning, we need more control over them. And with the consolidation, the farm consolidation is just incredible. So being able to invest in farms is definitely a possibility. And it seems to me that one can invest in land, in real estate, and that's not a security. And if you put together your own lease, arguably that's not a security. If there's big a packager putting this all together, you may end up flirting with the security laws. But a lease in and of itself, buying real estate and leasing it out, is a type of investment.
I know in the Main Street Journal, we had a story, maybe it was a month ago, with some new investment company that is making it easier for at least accredited investors to put money into, early beginning farmers to buy, if not a permanent ownership interest, some ownership interest in parcels of land, so they can get going. And I thought that was really intriguing.
Did you ever see the documentary, The Real Dirt on Farmer John?
I did
He
not.
it's a wonderful. It's a wonderful. It's one of my favorite food documentaries. But he switches from conventional to organic, and then he keeps growing. He starts a CSA. It grows and grows and grows, and then finally, some of the members of his CSA go out and purchase land as an investment, and then lease it to him. And so it's a good investment for them, but they're just owning land and they're leasing it to him.
Very cool.
In Ohio, I don't know, I think it's not really a national trend, but in Ohio, we have something called an installment land contract,
which is effectively a it's like a lease, and usually it's used in residential property, but you could do it with farmland. And it's the rate that you're paying on it to use the land would be maybe a little bit higher than a usual lease rate, but if you keep paying on it over a certain period of time, in Ohio, once you get 20% equity in, your payments have amounted to a 20% interest in buying this. I mean, the installment contract comes with an agreement to transfer title at the end if the person who's leasing has made payments over the period of time that amount to the agreed price of the property. But for the person who's doing the leases, they perhaps need a less of a credit rating because they can always, the landowner still has title to the property until he or she's been paid off. But for the seller, it also means that you can sell something like a farm or a business real estate or whatever. It's more saleable to people whose credit isn't totally fabulous. So that's a type of hybrid instrument, and there are a lot of different hybrid instruments, sales and leasebacks, and all sorts of things that one can do that are creative. So I think putting creativity into the pot is really important. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is underwriting. And this is why I'm fascinated by the idea of participating with a bank, because the bank people know how to underwrite. But the downside of underwriting is that we have these FICO scores that may not be a very good indication of whether a particular business owner or human being is able to pay the debt. So if you could talk a little bit about that, that would be an interesting thing.
Yeah, so I mean we have I guess broadly speaking two kinds of universes here. So one universe is banking, where underwriting and credit scores and a very systemic approach to the investments or loans is undertaken. And then you have the Wild West of securities where the investors may or may not care about these things or be as diligent about these things. I mean, I think we should be, and I agree that FICO scores may or may not be that helpful. There's a cool organization that I discovered not so long ago called Silver Linings Businesses, and they have literally thousands of businesses, small businesses worldwide that they work with, and they have created a financing mechanism that completely bypasses FICO scores, where they are really, there's other indicators of what their sales are and relationships and what looking at their business planning. And this has proven to be really interesting and successful. And they've gotten a few bigger banks to invest in this charitably. But I do think, we should be experimenting with other methods of getting money to people who do not have and maybe never will have the FICO scores. This is true in the Native American context. I mean, most Native Americans, to the extent they have any assets at all, they're sitting on trust land held by the US government. And that land cannot be used for any mortgage or any borrowing whatsoever. So they're completely stuck in trying to raise capital for themselves. So we've got to be creative in developing these other mechanisms.
I'm also thinking, though, in terms of underwriting the character and integrity and competency of someone in whose business you want to invest. And that, may be slightly related to credit ratings in the sense that somebody who's a deadbeat is going to have a bad credit rating, but aren't there a lot of businesses that might not be able to get bank loans? Or whose bank lo or who are financing their businesses on credit cards at rates of 20 or I think even higher than 25%.
Yeah, probably now. Yeah.
And if they have a local business that is doing well, that from the perspective of me as an investor is really more important than what the credit score is, assuming the person is someone of integrity and competence.
Yes. And I think so. It's a little early to know what the track record of investment crowdfunding is going to be in terms of repayment, because most of these transactions have occurred just in the last couple of years. And, you know, they spell out, at least those that are doing debt notes, maybe 4 or 5 years for repayment. But we'll soon have a raft of data about what works and what doesn't work. I hope we can draw some good inferences, some good ideas about other ways of constructing investment systems so that people, you know, with little wealth and few little credit history can nevertheless start or grow businesses.
So I just wanted to interrupt and bring up a point, because I think one of the most important things that Michael said today is that your local economy, your local businesses are a relationship economy. It's a relationship. It's all about relationships. And I've seen many people go at local investing and some be very successful and some not. And the people who are successful at local investing, first of all, they have great patience. They take their time to do, as Carolyn said, to underwrite. But the other thing is they create effective relationships. And they don't just bring money to an investment. They also bring knowledge and network and other attributes that help the business be successful. So they're almost, you know, they're not just an investor, they're a real supporter of the business. And they help bring an energy to the business that makes the business go. And most importantly, when they put in money, they can be trusted. They don't take the information they learn and spread it around the community, because there's no business owner that wants to face an irate parent at the PTA who's got information from their investor, right? So I think, you know, I think this idea of being, taking the time to build relationships and taking the time to get to know people and taking the time to be a successful investor, you know, it's more than just an investment game, it's a relationship thing.
And as advice to would-be local investors, I'd say, if you have a relationship with the business and you like it, you love it, you've talked with the employees, talked with the manager, and you have confidence in the business, that's a good investment. If it just seems like an interesting idea and you don't have a relationship with the business, that probably is a signal that it's not a good investment for you.
Right.
There's no substitute too for if you're an expert in a particular area. Let's say you fix up cars. You know, you tinker with cars. You know all about mechanics. And you know people who are mechanics and have auto service businesses. You know what a good business is and what a good business isn't. And
yeah,
if it's a local business, you've heard all the rumors about whether they're trustworthy or not. So we're just about out of time, but I wanted, because I don't think we've emphasized enough, to have you repeat what I've heard you say before about how profitable small businesses are in comparison to big businesses and listed companies.
Right. So this turns out to be a remarkable thing that is not well appreciated. There aren't great studies that have been done, but we know from U.S. tax forms that are filed that sole proprietorships, where most local businesses start or are, they tend to be about 10 times more profitable than C-Corps. with partnerships falling somewhere in between. In Canada, they've done a look at profitability by the size of the enterprise. And the most profitable businesses have 10 to 20 employees. The least profitable businesses are those with over 500 employees, that is, those traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So, you know, these are just clues about profitability, and they don't tell you how any given business you're looking at is going to perform. But it is a mistake to just assume that small businesses can't be as profitable as Fortune 500 companies.
Right. Well, I want to thank you, Michael, and Catherine can jump in with any closing remarks that she wants, but I want to thank you and to say how important I think that your message is. And I hope that you continue to participate creatively to inspire things like local stock exchanges and some of the things that you've alluded to that are in stages of incubation rather than maturity.
So, well, I appreciate that. It's a long road, but I will say as a positive thing that Catherine, you and I first met in the middle of the 1990s, I think, for lunch at University of Pennsylvania. And I never dreamed it would be possible to fundamentally alter U.S. securities law. Now that we have seen how it's possible with the Jobs Act, I feel like the sky's the limit, and we need to make all of these other changes. So dream big, and we'll make it happen.
So I just want to mention one thing. You know, my neighbors, and I think that this is why I agree with you. My neighbors in Tennessee can put an infinite amount of money in the lottery. They can put an infinite amount of money into illegal drugs, no problem. But they can't invest in a small business without going to jail. And I think the time has come when people are going to look at that and say, you know something? That's politics. That has nothing to do with protecting me from financial fraud.
Absolutely.
So I'm with you. I think there is time for breakthrough. And the reality is we can't make it through the transition we're going through economically without these kinds of reviving local economies. It can't happen. And I think that's becoming pretty obvious to people. So it's time for real breakthroughs.
Yep.
Okay, so you've got to tell us again, remind all the listeners how they find your websites, how they find your books, how they find you, how they follow your work.
So I have two websites that are kind of connected to each other. One is michaelhschuman.com, and Schuman is S-H-U-M-A-N. And the other is themainstreetjournal.org. And that has the newsletter that comes out every other week. And in both of them, I communicate about books and about workshops and other fun things that are coming up. And if you just want to reach out to me by email, my address is Schuman, again, S-H-U-M-A-N, at igc.org.
Well, Michael, one of the things I'm so grateful for is whenever I talk with you, whether we're remote or in person, what I get from you is the love of enterprise, the love of creating enterprise, the fun of investing. You know, you bring that juice. And if you grew up in Philly or worked in New York, it's a kind of juice anyway, but you certainly make us want to get up and get out our wallet and try and make it work again. So Carolyn, any last thoughts before we say goodbye?
No, other than we have to find new ways of building our future and restoring some of what we lost during the pandemic. And I think some of Michael's thoughts and ideas are really valuable in determining how we go forward.
Yep. Okay. Michael, thank you again. Have a great day.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time.